Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the five books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study.
We continue our exposition of the book of Exodus, concentrating on the life of Moses that we might learn better about our God and how to walk with Him through the example of Moses, both in Moses' good points and in his bad points. We're looking at the narrative in chapter 4, beginning with verse 18. Moses has been commissioned of God after 40 years in the wilderness out in the tribal areas of the Midianites to return to Egypt, to leave his father-in-law Jethro, and to go back to Egypt to confront Pharaoh, and to be God's instrument in liberating his people. So the Lord has told Moses to go, and then Moses departed faithfully. And he returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and he said to him, "Please let me go, that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive." And Jethro gave Moses his blessing, "Go in peace." We talked a lot about the appropriateness of that, and we won't spend any more time on that particular point. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt." The force of the language there is that the Lord had said to Moses, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." That's an important point. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And he also took the staff of God in his hand, which was a symbol of his divine authority, much as the word of God in our hand is the symbol of our authority in the service of the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I put in your power." But I'm paraphrasing. "I will tell you in advance, Moses, I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. You shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn,'" in other words, "my favored son. So I said to you, 'Let my people go, that he may serve me,' but you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. We were making the point as we asked, what can we learn about walking with God from Moses' experience in this text? And we were saying in our last program that sometimes to get back where we want to be, we have to go back to where we were, where we got off track. And so it was with Moses. And as I say, we talked a lot about Moses conforming to the customs of the time, when that's appropriate and when that's not appropriate, and going back and seeking the blessing of Jethro, his father-in-law, before he headed out to Egypt, gathered up his family, and took off. In verse 19, the Lord said to Moses, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." Here I'd make a note about Moses' sparse or parsimonious orders. As someone has said, light is given to us to know what step we should take. Just enough light and not a lot more. Go back to Egypt was God's instruction. Sometimes we hesitate because we cannot see the step beyond. I mean, we hesitate sometime in doing what the Lord is prompting us to do. Sometimes we hesitate because we cannot see the reason. Sometimes we hesitate because we're not satisfied to act on the conviction of known duty, or because we dread the awful pain that threatens to benumb us and turn our hearts sick. But so long as we refuse to act, folks, that light cannot increase, but it begins inevitably to decline. Obedience is the one condition for light's increase, nay, for its maintenance at all. F.B. Meyer. Now let me make a note here about God's clear direction. God's telling Moses, go back to Egypt. Again, I quote Meyer, who's always full of wisdom. "It may be long since you heard God's voice, and disobedience is the cause." Meyer says, "You have disobeyed the distinct word of the Lord, and you will never get back into the warm, blessed circle of God's manifested presence, where his face smiles and his voice speaks, till you've gone back to the place where you dropped the thread of obedience, and taking it up where you left it, do what you know to be the word and will of God. Then, as you start to obey, the voice of God will greet you once more with old familiar tones." Very wise words. He tells Moses to go back to Egypt. Those were his bare and sparse instructions. He does add that all the men who were seeking your life, Moses had been under a death sentence since he killed that Egyptian when he prematurely jumped out and wanted to champion the cause of the people of Israel, and did so in a great flurry of self-confidence, but he was way ahead of God. So he was on Pharaoh's hit list. The Lord tells him, "Now all the men who were seeking your life are dead." I want to ask the question, it's interesting. Why did this timing, when the men who were seeking Moses' life had passed away, that particular government had gone to the grave, why did this particular timing figure in the providential equation of raising Moses up now at this time? Well, again, as I said, Moses had been on Pharaoh's most wanted list for decades. His intelligence agency doubtless had kept a sharp eye out for him to sneak back into the land. They feared Moses because he might incite an uprising among the Hebrew slaves and stir up unwanted trouble for Pharaoh. Now that regime and their issues with Moses had passed away. A new administration is in place, and Moses is no longer prominently on the radar screen of the Egyptian secret service. So the time is propitious for Moses to stage his return. Why? Well, this is all instructive about the wisdom of God's providence. It's a good lesson for us in patience and getting ahead of ourselves and not staying within our game, but trying to force things with all good intentions. God had Moses wait for the death of the principals of the previous regime for at least one good reason I can think of. Had Moses gone back to Egypt to face his old nemesis, Thutmose, the issue between Pharaoh and Moses would have been confused. On the face of it, Thutmose could have spun the issue, the contest between the two of them, as a matter of national security, The last time that Pharaoh saw Moses, Moses was up in his eyes to no good. In the eyes of Thutmose III, he was seditious from the Egyptian point of view. Moses was out there stirring up Hebrew slaves, sowing unrest, and was guilty of killing a government officer in the process. Clearly, he was a dangerous man to the state, and his present proposal to Pharaoh would have been viewed with suspicion. It would not have been seen in any way, shape, or form as a mission from any Hebrew god, but it would have been looked upon as an excuse and a ploy to free their Hebrew slaves. So, had Moses gone back earlier, in the providence of God, this would have been about politics, not religion, not God. It could all have been confused, and the issues may have cast doubts upon Moses' motivation. So this comment of the Lord to Moses, I want you to go. I want you to go now, because this is the right time. Those who were out to kill you, those who were out to take your life, all of those are dead. It says something else we ought to note about God's way of doing things. It is this. Take careful note, people. God prefers the subtle to the sensational. God prefers the still small voice to the earthquake approach in getting his work done. A lot of people don't get that, and a lot of people today don't get that. That doesn't mean it's always one way as opposed to the other. But the point that I'm making here, the point that we should see, the inference we should draw from this, for one thing, is just what I said, and I'd like to repeat it. God prefers the subtle to the sensational in getting his work done. God prefers, as we saw in the case of Elijah, the still small voice to the earthquake and fire approach of getting his work done. Generally speaking, to put it another way, God prefers to work providentially, that is, through human or other kinds of means, rather than working directly supernaturally. That is, in the ordinary, and I do emphasize ordinary, course of events, God orders quiet, subtle confluence of unspectacular secondary causes to accomplish his purposes. He brings things to pass when we never knew he was in the mix of circumstances, and that is the providence of God. The supernatural is when God, for his own special reasons, contravenes nature, and he does what we commonly term the miraculous. That is, in some way, God, our Creator, our sovereign Creator, modifies or suspends temporarily the regular rhythms or those natural regularities that scientists like to call the laws of nature. These ways of working are the rare exceptions rather than the rule with God. They are spectacular exhibitions of supernatural power. They do inspire awe and wonder, of course. But God tends to reserve those for unique times and situations for special effects. That's not an everyday thing. By the way, our modern Pentecostal and charismatic friends, in my opinion, do a great disservice to the church when they nurture the idea that miracles are as regular as sunshine and available every day for just the asking. Folks, this leads to great disillusionment on one hand, and all sorts of dumbing down of the very idea of signs and wonders, so that people are calling all kinds of things miracles which are not miracles at all. And that, in turn, engenders cynicism. That is a big problem. Well, here, God telling Moses, all of those who sought your life are dead. Here's a classic example of divine providence. God is not bound by nature or its processes. He does not have to wait on them before he can act. But generally speaking, he providentially works through secondary causes to achieve his end. And in this case, the expiration of those who were seeking the life of Moses. A series of presumably natural deaths in this case, all in God's providence. He didn't reach into their palaces and strike them dead with a bolt of lightning. Behind the scenes, his divine hand, sight unseen, quietly and unobtrusively pulled the plug on Moses' enemies until no threat to Moses remains and the political decks are cleared. Folks, there is usually a providential naturalness about God's timing in such things. Usually God does not need and does not prefer to turn nature or history on its ear to accomplish his secret purposes. God has hold of all the threads of human life and events. God has hold of all the processes of nature, and he coordinates all to serve his end. So often we look at his timing, and we're just amazed at the naturalness of it all. To the undiscerning eye, it all looks coincidental, or, in street language, looks lucky, with no reference to God. But to the eyes of men and women of God, what we see is just his secret providence putting all his ducks in a row. I remember way back in 1991 when we were meeting in a building 8 miles south of here, and we were just having a terrible time getting our building started on this property where Lake now stands. It was in a time of a banking crisis. Some of you may remember it. It wasn't easy to get financing, and we certainly didn't have nearly enough money to build it ourselves at that time, but we desperately needed it to get it going. And one reason we desperately needed to get it going was because we had had an extension of building permits over the years, and it had never happened. And the city in which we live is a little difficult on those issues anyway, and all knew that we weren't going to get a fourth extension. So we waited and we prayed and we waited and we prayed. And then one day, one of our men who was in touch with the financial world called and let us know that there was a big financial entity that had interest in loaning us the money. Wow. But the meter was running. I'll truncate the story. We went into fast mode and got them all the information that they required, boxes and boxes and boxes of it. But at the end, we broke ground. If I recall, it was 3 days before our permit, city permit, expired. It's just amazing about God's timing. And of course, I could go on, and perhaps you too, telling stories of that very thing. Was it a miracle? No. It was God's providence at work, however. So Moses, we read in verse 20, took his wife and his sons, and he mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. That is, Moses started his return. Moses was going to get there. He also took the staff of God in his hands. And talk about the strange ways of God. Folks, it was never the Lord's plan for Moses and his wife and children to accompany him into Egypt. But it was God's plan for them to start the trip, to get far enough away from home, and to get far enough away from Zipporah, Moses' wife, get far enough away from her support system, and then create a crisis that would rectify an unresolved spiritual issue in the family. About the spiritual issue, Moses had been very negligent, and his wife, Zipporah, quite obstreperous and defiant. Well, God brought the thing to a head where Moses and Zipporah had to fish or cut bait. He, God, threw down the gauntlet. We note first, however, before more comment on that Moses took the staff of God in his hand. Please note, the staff of Moses is now the staff of God. God had taken over an ordinary instrument. God had sanctified it. He had set it apart for sacred use. In other words, and now that staff belongs to him. It's something through which God will manifest his power. So it is with everything that God takes for himself, ordinary men and women whom he reserves for himself. God takes ordinary men and calls them men of God, just like this is called the staff of God. The church and assembly is called the church of God. In other words, nothing common, but a sacred community in which he works and lives. Unlike his early years in Egypt, this time Moses goes forth in the Lord's strength, that staff being the symbol, being Moses' own peculiar scepter. He goes forth in the Lord's strength, this time not his own, the staff of God being an ever-present reminder that this was God's mission, not Moses, and also a reminder to Moses of what weak things could do when wielded by God's almighty hands behind them. A mere shepherd's crook was now the rod of God, destined to be employed for deeds of transcendent power, as someone has put it. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders I put in your power, that is, in your hand, and I'm going to harden his heart, and he will not let the people go at first," that is. What the Lord is telling Moses in shorthand is, Moses, stay on plan, play out your hand, and don't expect a quick shock-and-awe campaign of miracles to put a dent in Pharaoh's will to resist. My plan, Moses, is not a sudden victory. Instead, I'm going to gradually harden this man beyond redemption, and in the process, I'm going to make my name renowned in a way that will leave an everlasting imprint on the psyche of Israel and the surrounding nations. So, Moses, do as you're told. Don't throw in the towel when Pharaoh is not suddenly overawed by the miracles I'll put in your hand. Let me do what I sent you for. I have many balls in the air, and this has to be done my way. I will harden his heart so he will not let the people go. Well, question may be asked, is it right of God, first of all? Folks, God is the measure of all things. Right is not a standard external to God by which he is measured. The standard of his moral being is that by which God measures all things. Apart from God, there is no right or wrong. He is the standard, and he is the origin, the source of the very idea of morality. If God does it, it is by definition right. And if we question him, we are by definition out to lunch. In the Hebrew way of thinking, God is the first cause of everything, though that does not absolve human actors of moral responsibility. It just means that God is sovereign, that he directs things, that he makes actions certain, get this, but without making them necessary. God never forces people to act against their moral disposition, but he uses their inclinations, like Pharaoh's, to his own purposes, or else he changes their moral inclinations without overriding their wills. So God hardened Pharaoh's heart in the sense that he ordered, arranged, and superintended circumstances so that Pharaoh's will was bent and gradually and irretrievably sealed in the direction in which it was naturally bent. Yet Pharaoh is said to have hardened his heart in these narratives we'll see later, and that he stubbornly resisted God, was allowed to resist God to the point that finally Pharaoh fixed himself hopelessly in that adverse spiritual posture. Both are true. God did it in that he dictated the circumstances and influences that Pharaoh would resist and bent his tree in a fixed position. But Pharaoh did it in that he resisted those circumstances and reacted to those influences in such a way that he became totally insensitive to God. There is a way it could be said of a Marine drill sergeant that he toughened up those soldiers. By the same token, it could be equally correctly said that those same soldiers toughened themselves. Take the illustration of a personal trainer hardening the abs of a client, because the trainer gave the client something to resist, which the client was inclined to do anyway. Or we could say the client hardened his own abs because he resisted the trainer's medicine ball as he wanted to do. So this is no so-called moral problem, God hardening Pharaoh. There's no fairness issue here. Folks, God can never be unfair to any human being any more than you can be unfair to a lump of dirt or anything you've created. First of all, God owes no human being anything. Not anything, ever. God gave us life. He has the right, by dint of being the sovereign creator, to do exactly what he pleases with any life that he creates. But our position before him is even weaker than that. It's not simply that he's our creator and has the sovereign right to dispose of any of us as he wills, but the fact that we are all corrupted, ruined creatures, by nature and by choice. Even if there were some moral obligation to his creatures, which there is not inherently, that is dissolved by our fallen condition. God owes no human being anything. If he hardened all and saved none, it would be nothing more than all deserved. Well, we've got to leave it right there. We'll come back next time, dear friends. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.